Welcome to a new episode of the Case Podcast. Today, our guest is Simon Harra, CEO and co-founder of Entropy Data, recently founded company. Besides that, there is a long list, a man of many talents, so to speak, PhD in computer science, author of Java by Comparison book by Pragmatic Programmers, I guess. Maintainer and co-author of mop.sh, so a tool for mop programming, ensemble programming, author of the GitOps primer, translator of the data mesh book, many things. Welcome, Simon.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
And also Alex and Heinrich. How are you doing, guys?
It's very hot in here.
Yeah, I'm burning a lot of energy here on my air condition. Yeah.
Nice. I hope it's coming from solar energy.
No. But it's oh, actually, I have at least it's a green power, I must say.
We're diving straight into our first agenda topic. Sven's home lab setup.
Yeah. But I must say, talking about maybe a little anecdote, to warm up, with the heat. A few colleagues of mine and me, we translated a book from Gregor Hoppe, A Cloud Strategy, and Gregor lives in Singapore. And we translated it 1 year ago. We started with a translation. One of my colleagues said, it's so hot here under the roof. And Gregor was like, good morning, Singapore. We had 28 degrees at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then my colleague said, but you have air condition. And then Gregor was like, you cannot run air condition all the time. You just have to get used to the heat. It's
okay.
All right. So let's dive into the topic. I already said it. Entropy Data. Maybe you can say a few words about the company. What are you guys doing?
Mm-hmm. So we just founded in August 2025 together with Jochen Christ. It's a spin-off from InnoQ, and it markets the Data Mesh Manager. That's a data marketplace built on data products and data contracts. And that's really helpful to really large companies because it's an internal data marketplace where teams can share data with other teams in a way to build trust and to build cool things on top of that data.
It's really interesting.
Really an interesting situation right now. So we did this step because the product grew at InnoQ, and we already have a lot of customers, so we are not VC funded, we are bootstrapped, and we are break even, and really want to grow now, and it's kind of, it feels the right time. The data becomes very important with the rise of AI, and we have so many inbound leads. So it's really a really interesting topic at the moment.
So Simon, can you give some career advice? How do you go from Java programmer over to data and CEO of a data company?
It was a long way, so to say. But maybe I'll share that story because I think it might be interesting. So I'm a software engineer at heart. And I was at InnoQ doing a consultancy project for Breuninger, where we built, as part of the e-commerce system, so their e-commerce vendor, we built the distributed order management. And it was part of this InnoQ team. We did mob programming, as you already mentioned. It was really a fun time there. And at some point, while we worked there, something happened in my life that has never happened before. The backlog went dry. And at the same time, people from their data team said, hey, we've got BigQuery, who wants to try it out? And so we said, oh, well, actually, we don't have too much to do at the moment. Let's try it out. So we pumped our data from our operational systems that we've built, like self-contained systems. We pumped that to BigQuery from all the self-contained systems into one BigQuery project. And we started doing analytical analysis queries on all of that data. And that's how we transitioned into a hypothesis-driven product team by the books. So we really evaluated all the user stories that we got or that we, some ideas we had with data first. And then we decided whether it's sensible to really follow up to, and build the feature. And then after we built the features, we could really evaluate whether they had the impact we prognosted. And that was really my way into the data world. Because in the end, what we were there, just to point a little in the future, so we were the small domain team that not only had ownership of the operational data, but also on the analytical data, like the whole end-to-end ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And one could say this is kind of the idea of data mesh. And the BigQuery was our self-service data platform. We were the domain team. But governance was not really there too much. We didn't share data products on. But in the end, we had this first step of bottom-up approach of data mesh, I would say.
Would you advocate for such? I can imagine it's quite a stretch because usually people consuming analytics data are different types of stakeholders than those that are interested in the product management and bringing features to customers, isn't it?
There are some people that use the data in a different way. Maybe you have to do some reporting, but as a product team, you need your own data and also data from other teams to make mm-hmm. your product better. And the best way to do that is using an analytics platform, because then you can crunch a lot of data. You can combine it very easily. But this is the problem, I think. And that's also the easiest way to get the culture in, because how do you convince software people or not to share data with others? The best way is you need data from others as well. And so you will be part, try to be a good citizen in that ecosystem, because you know you need something from the others as well. And so you try to be helpful as well.
Yeah, I'm not very good, I assume, in analyzing data, at least not as good as, let's say, a data scientist. Before we dive into the marketplace and data products and stuff like that, maybe also one further question. How should a team do that? So should I build up this expertise, becoming, you know, an analytics expert, or is it that, you know, in the sense of team topologies, there is an enabling team which supports me with all the knowledge that I, you know, be able to analyze data in a certain way?
Bottleneck is always domain knowledge. It's not, it's not the knowledge of how to do data analysis, but it's more like you have to have the domain knowledge, and mm-hmm. then you can be supported to do the analysis on your own. So it's much easier to get people from an enabling team into your team, so they help you to learn these sort of few analysis skills.
Okay.
But then the other way around. So we tried the other way around to say we've put all data scientists in one team, and then they had to acquire the domain knowledge from all around the company. And that created a much, much more problematic bottleneck,
yeah, exactly. I would say.
And this is exactly the situation where companies are often in, and they don't want that anymore. They want to go really in a domain-oriented architecture, domain-driven design also follows a little bit like that approach. That's also the approach for this enabling team and the platform team. Because both help. So having a good platform, an easy to use self-service platform also helps these domain teams make it easier for them to do the analysis,
okay,
or for sharing data on or using other teams' data. So that's, yeah. So I would say yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. So I would just start now with let's start from data marketplace, then go to data products, and then eventually to a data contract. So what is a data marketplace? And I think you wrote an article, I believe, about it. You compare it to a data catalog. I must say we had an episode with Christoph Windhäuser and on data architecture, and he said, yeah, the data catalog is, so to speak, the heart of data architecture. So yeah, please explain what a marketplace is, mm-hmm, and how it compares to a data catalog.
So to me, most modern, or basically all modern data approaches, go towards this federated approach. So you have federated teams, decentralized teams that own their data, and they have to share it on. But for that to work, you need a central place where everything comes together. Where we can monitor, where you can govern, where you can manage what one team owns and shares and who's using it and so on and so forth. You have to coordinate that. And the data marketplace to me is the system. This is where everybody meets. The owner of data who shares data on. The consumer can look for data, can request access, and then use the data. We can also ensure trust. Think of an entry in the marketplace where we see, these are the data guarantees around. We are guaranteed this data schema. We are guaranteed that in this column are at most 5% null values. And we also see the green check mark next to it, which says, okay, this is automatically checked. And governance is at the marketplace because they want to ensure that only data that follows certain rules, certain policies, is shared, and it's shared in a correct way, not to violate GDPR or other constraints. And platform is interested in as well, because you can automate a lot around that. Maybe someone requests access to data, and then it's getting approved. Then we need to automatically make sure that the people really have access where the data is actually in some buckets or SQL tables or so on. So everybody kind of meets in this marketplace. And that's why I think this is so such an essential component. And the details page, that's what I see, is the details page in the data marketplace should be the data product. And the guarantees around data that I'm sharing should be captured in the data contract. And with that, this is what I think works. And what we had previously, what was classified as a data catalog, often did not work. So they were very expensive, and they had this functionality of scraping the whole company. Every SQL table was scraped and put in the data catalog. And then governance said, okay, let's assign ownership, and then say, okay, you own it now, you have to document this now.
Mm-hmm. And keep it updated, right?
Yeah. And that did not work. No one had an incentive to actually keep that up to date. There was a lot of sc- scraped metadata in from maybe tables that were not for sharing, but just internal tables. Yep. So I've never experienced a company that said we are proud of our data catalog and it brings the value that we think, and it's a good ROI. I've never heard about that.
It's like just looking at all your GitHub issues or your Jira issues, right? So never somebody kind of proud of the whole collection. It really matters that the things that are important move forward, right?
Obviously, I would say, a cultural topic. Isn't that related to what you said in the beginning? Like, you said, hey, let's be a good citizen because we depend on the others. So let's be a role model and deliver what we expect from others. Is that what you want to, so to say, formalize in a data marketplace?
In some way, yes. For me, it's more this. I just put the data I want to share in the marketplace, mm-hmm. and this is curated, and this is a step I take. I don't know the word, bewusst, consciously. And I put this there, I own it, and I add also guarantees to that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the other way around. So I am totally against automatically creating data products. Because this has to be a step where I do this, I can help with a lot of tools to make it easy to do that, mm-hmm. of course. But it should be a conscious step.
Would it help maybe... Let's just assume listeners have heard about the term data products, but they are used to, let's say, classical API publishing. So having an API spec that I publish, and maybe people know where the different instances of my application reside, what the URL is, and where they can find that API. How would you compare that to a data product being published in a data marketplace?
Think of a data product like a microservice or self-contained system.
Mm-hmm.
And the data contracts are basically the API specification.
Is it just an OpenAPI 3 spec, or is there more to it?
Yeah, so the data contracts come with their own YAML specification.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most popular one is the Open Data Contract Standard from the Linux Foundation. And to clarify, I'm also part of the technical steering committee driving this open standard.
Okay. That's probably something that we should dive into deeper. If I look into Sven's face, that's a topic where we have a lot of questions, right?
Yeah, exactly. But
let's stick to the data products mm-hmm. for a second. So you said a data product is like a microservice.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I have in mind is, when I publish an API, I'm usually very careful with what I publish because I'm aware things that I published once are hard to take back. So mm-hmm. I'm never publishing all the data that I have. At the same time, I would like my colleagues to know which data I have so they could ask me for it. So they know, okay, the data is available somewhere in the company. Alex and his team has it. So how would I do that?
Yeah, so what we would recommend is specifying a proposed data product
mm-hmm.
with a data contract. And in the data contract, it's also in the proposed state. And you could describe, your data model. Mm-hmm. But it's not yet published. It's not yet implemented. No one can build something on it. You can just say, "Hey, this is what I own. This is what cool. I'm what I could share."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a proposal, not only on I have this data and could share it, but also a proposal how I would want to share it.
Both ways would work. Yeah? Cool. I think then the discussion will start, and you can. Define the interface, perhaps even together with your initial customer,
mm-hmm.
but by still thinking about how could it be more helpful to many others, because the idea still with a data product is sharing data so many can use it.
Yeah, at the same time, I'm a big fan of the statement, you have to pay twice before it's cheap, right? Only after the third time someone asks for it, I create this general abstraction and a general interface.
Yeah, but in the when you maybe coming more from the software engineering or side, and you have your operational system and want to share that data, mm-hmm. You might already have a good API from your operational system. Thinking of your aggregate that you share in your operational system. Speaking in domain-driven design terms. Yeah. And you might have a feed implementation or a REST API where you can look at the current state of your aggregate.
Yeah.
That's probably very interesting to data people. And not having this table where you see the current snapshot of this aggregate and also how it evolves over time, that's already a good first guess.
It's interesting. I'm seeing a rabbit hole there, and I'm wondering whether we should go into that in terms of API design, because most of the APIs that I see are, I can query the current state rather than APIs that are emitting events that occurred within the system. That's only very seldomly seen, at least in my environment and the systems that I see, unfortunately, I have to say.
Just one quick comment on that, because I also find this very interesting. So what we in the data world, what you don't want to do is re-implement business logic you already have implemented in an operational system.
Yeah.
So, and agreed. You don't want to interpret events and determine the state again, especially maybe for simple business logic that works, it's very stable. But if it's more complex business logic, you might end up with the wrong data, wrong conclusions, and that's horrible. We don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So there's no alternative to just get the aggregation states, because otherwise you have to re-implement the business logic ending in the current state. So otherwise it would be event sourcing, basically, and re-implement event sourcing in the data platform. Sure you want to do that.
I couldn't agree more, Simon. That's coming back to the statement that you phrased earlier. Domain knowledge is always the bottleneck, right? And only those with the domain knowledge know how to properly aggregate their domain's events, right? The point that I wanted to make is basically that the people that have the domain knowledge should be the ones understanding what are the questions of the consumer, no matter whether it's an operational API or a data analytics API that I'm specifying.
Hmm. Can we come up with an example? Let's say an example data product.
I can tell. We had a talk about one of our clients gave a talk, and they told about their most important data product. And I think that's an interesting story. So their most important data product, it's a large logistics company, and that most important data product was the shipments data product. Because it's a large logistics company, they have shipments for the road, sea, air, water, I don't know, there are systems for each of that, and it's very complicated, and it's very hard to get the data. And what they did is they created this shipments data product, and it has four different output ports, so the same data, but it's available through a REST API, a Kafka topic, on as SQL tables on Snowflake, and as, I think, JSON files on AWS S3.
Mm. So the data product shipment, it's what's... How would I imagine it? Is it the... We say we have a description of this product. We say, hey, we offer data about all kinds of shipments. we have.
Yeah, all the shipments of the company, regardless where they are right now, you get the picture. You can always track the thing, and it's fed by a lot of systems. It's a clean interface. It doesn't have all the details, right? But it's so valuable that it's the most popular thing. And they told in the talk that it enabled a lot of interesting new use cases.
I would add two examples here. First one, I would also think about companies that's selling data sets. I think here the data product is just very literally true. I think a couple of our colleagues we met at the InnoQ roundtable are actually in that business of selling really data sets to others. And you can imagine like different channels through which you make the data available, but you are on the hook for the quality and availability of the data as a vendor very directly. And there are certain SLAs with regards to kind of freshness associated to this that you guarantee to your customers. And then in e-commerce context, I think there is the user data product that I would think is extremely important to know who is your users, which traditionally may be just a SQL table, but in federated architectures, this gets a lot more subtle than this. There are many, many different systems who build up a opinion on what a user is and what attributes are associated to them. And there's a lot of duplication. So having an authoritative source and a team that is kind of accountable to having up-to-date user data and providing it to everybody else, I think that is kind of an important kind of asset. Similarly, sales orders, right? That's also something that a lot of systems touch. And I think then you also have data sets that are more internal or data products that are more kind of like, for example, on the platform. We do have data sets about like all employees that we have. We have data sets about all applications. And also here, they are different ways to query the data. There are different ways to view the data. But I think this kind of governance and accountability structures there are quite important, that there is somebody you can go to that will take ownership of this. And if there are issues in the data or in the way they are made available, that they will kind of take ownership of this, fix them, and also document the data set in a way that others can discover it and leverage it in a self-serviceable manner. So you don't have to kind of go to people or read source code in order to make use of a data set.
Hmm.
This is how I see it. Simon, does that resonate? Would you kind of draw different accents here?
Yeah, no, I would fully agree. Maybe we can use the classification of data products from Shamak Degani from her book, because we have this, what we talked about were the aggregated data products, products that, are fed from many different systems. We have created a unified data model. They have a lot of value in the company. And they have a lot of different use cases where they could apply to. But they are kind of the middle layer. On the bottom layer, we have the source-aligned data products, which are offered data mostly from one source system. And their data model is heavily linked to the model of the source system.
Yeah.
The very dependent. So when the source system changes, they can't really do that much. They have to follow a follower basically from the model. Now we could, and that's the lower part. Then we touch the middle layer, the aggregated layer, and then we have the more consumer aligned data products. This is where we produce maybe a data mart for a specific set of reports or for a specific team. And so we have a limited number of people where we produce data for.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the, no, that, that might help.
What is a data mart?
Think of like a small data warehouse with a specific group of people in mind.
Okay.
I mean, isn't kind of management stakeholders a typical example here? So you have management reports that you're producing And they're obviously very important, but only a handful of people read them.
Yes. Yeah. I think of a data map for finance, a data that's just feeding, used for creating finance reports. And the underlying data for those reports, they should also be captured in this case, consumer aligned data product.
All right. Yeah, wonderful. So I actually, more than 10 years ago, I think I worked on a data product. No, actually, we sold data. Actually, we aggregated data, but there were no terms, or at least we didn't know any terms or structure. We just did stuff and sold data. Yeah. So now we had the data marketplace. We now know what a data product is. Now eventually we come to the data contract. So what is a data contract?
Let me just say before we come to that, so just one more word for the data product, because this gives us the mindset. With the data product, the core idea is to share data so that it's good for my consumers. So I share it in a way that it's easy to use and perfect for my consumers. That's the core idea, the product thinking idea of a data product. I have the consumer in mind. I want to help them. I want to build it so they can easily use it. Maybe I use the technologies that are good for my consumers. I create a data model that is good for my consumers, so that they can benefit.
Mm. Then again, Simon, what is the difference to a regular API specification? Because I would assume that when people design an API, they also have the consumers in mind, and they make some assumptions on how it will be interacted with, even though they don't specify that.
Yeah, nothing. Absolutely nothing. The only thing is that in the data world, when we had this situation where people just dumped data somewhere and thought this is valuable.
Mm-hmm. S3 bucket, internet readable. Great idea. Yeah.
Well, that internet readable, more enterprise readable, you just mm-hmm. dumped it there and you thought this was valuable as it's an asset. And it was that we thought about a data lake, yeah, and we have to fish for the gold in there. Yeah. And sometimes some person will go there and find the gold and everybody will be happy.
What's that phrase again? Is it a piece of art or is it a trash dump?
It was a trash dump. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
it was a costly one.
Yeah. On the other side, I mean, with one of my current customers, which is large enterprise IT, we also deal with a lot of APIs, and no one is a bit too extreme, but lots of those teams who offer the API, we have to explain them that they have to talk to us. We are their customers. You know, you have to, they don't give a shit. You know, they just build something and think that's probably useful. So I think also I would assume in the data world, it's the same. You know, you see your data product as something you want to have users. You want to have your users. You offer a product, but probably the product thinking is not in most of the teams,
Development teams. I would argue from a domain-driven design perspective, you are a conformist, or at least the producer thinks you are a conformist.
Exactly. But I am not, yeah? Because, even if I'm the, they don't even think, well, probably we have to explain the terms a bit, yeah? So domain-driven design, talks
strategic
about
design
talks about different types patterns. of relationships. So you can be a conformist. You have to eat what your supplier gives you.
But because you don't have a connection or relationship to them, so you can negotiate the interface. You cannot negotiate, so you just have to accept.
Which is fine, you know, if you're Google or if you're AWS, you have so many clients, you have to come up with something, yeah? Mm-hmm. And I mean, if I say something, I want the interface different, the API, they don't care about me. But in another setting, I rather want another relationship, you know, I want that people talk to me, and also to possible other consumers. And I see that as a problem, with normal APIs. And I would also see that with data products.
The point for me being, and Simon, please correct me, what I understood from data contracts is they make a relationship more reliable because each side knows what to expect from the other.
Data contracts, are you saying?
Data contracts, yes.
We are not at the data contracts yet.
Wait. The point is here, reliability in terms of I know what to expect. The point that I'm trying to make is I only know very few people who wrap their head around strategic design and intentionally designing such relationships. So you say, well, I'm not a conformist, but obviously political relationships at your client say, well, you are, because otherwise the team that is offering the data, so the supplier, would need to talk to you, and then you would have a customer supplier relationship. So if you had political power, so your team had political power, you could call them into a customer supplier relationship and say, I want to negotiate with you because I have the political power to do that, to force you into that.
To be honest, that's true. I mean, this is happening. You know, they see me as a conformist and I say, no, we are the customer. And you are our supplier, and also that team. Yeah. Please talk to us.
The interesting part for me
and they
is
do,
that
and they do. I must admit, most of them they do, right? So you can change that relationship. Sorry.
I mean, the interesting part here is, I mean, obviously that is pretty frustrating for people who have to be conformists and have to, so to say, have to accept what is offered to them. If it doesn't fit, then you have a problem and you cannot fulfill your team's goals, right? And sometimes it's pretty hard to make this visible, like to make it visible to your team's stakeholders. Hey, we are blocked. We cannot deliver our goals or our sprint goals, our monthly, quarterly goals, whatever, because we don't get the data from this other team's interface. And now again, Simon, correct me. Data contracts is a way to express what I would actually need in order to fulfill that goal and to very explicitly show what is missing.
Yes. So maybe moving on to data contracts. So data contracts is description of basically a data model, quality guarantees, service level agreements. And it can be defined either by one offering data, and it's a producer-driven data contract, so it's more guarantees. It's more, this is what I promise, and you can rely on that because it's my data. I share it. I own it. This is when you go there and you see the data contract and this, and we can also verify that automatically, and potential consumers can rely on what's there. Mm-hmm. And then there's the contract, the consumer driven data contract. This is when the consumer defines their expectations. Well, I actually need these columns and I need it with that SLA. And I do have these additional quality check constraints and so on and so forth. And both work. And the best both overlap. in some way. They should, yeah.
But that's the benefit that I see from data contracts and why I think people should wrap their head around that, because exactly aspects like freshness of data is something that you cannot express in regular API contracts. So your expectations, how fresh the data shall be, how available or during which time periods of the day the data should be available and in which, how do you say, a querying interval. So if you say, well, in the time between 9 in the morning and 6 p.m., I want to query your API every 60 seconds, and I want to have a freshness of data that's no older than 5 minutes. That is something that you cannot express in OpenAPI spec.
Yeah. So they're different. Yeah. They have their own, think of data contracts as guarantees around a large data set. Mm-hmm. The data set could span many tables, just using the table metaphor here. And you guarantee things around this whole data set. And it could be a structure, it could be these SLAs, it could also be governance things, like you are allowed to use that data for these purposes, but not for these.
Mm-hmm.
We can limit that. Maybe also you can use the data, but you cannot reshare it. So there could be additional terms and conditions as well. So it's a little bit more than we typically have experienced in the operational world.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's all this analytical data, there are constraints on what you can do with it. And in the operational world, you always have this Freifahrtschein, I don't know the English term, the free ticket, basically, because you can always say, we need this to do business. And then you're allowed to do a lot of stuff. And in the analytical world, you always have to verify, is this allowed? Do we have the purpose? Do we have the consent? Do we have whatever? And maybe you also buy data from outside and weather data, statistics data. And they also have come with license terms. You can do anything. Yeah. So mm-hmm. these are all aspects to the data contract.
I mean, one important dimension here, I think, is also tooling support or automated like integrations and checks. Because in order for this to actually work, you need some degree of like really hard linking and maybe some degree of discovery. You cannot purely make this a documentation exercise. You can think of a data catalog like a telephone book, and then you can have just a Google Docs process or an editorial process of kind of releasing the data catalog every month. And you can see how horrible that would be. And at the same time, just running a discovery cron job over your databases and seeing, hey, here are all the databases, that also clearly doesn't work. So I think there's a lot of kind of, on a practical level, a lot of the art is kind of making the tooling support seamless, but also really strictly positive in the value that it adds, since it should really support the developer in articulating the guarantees, expectations, and so on. And a lot of the journeys are actually starting extremely basic, right? I have a data set. I just put it on Google Drive as a zip file and share the link. That can be a data product, or it can be a spreadsheet where our customers are in it. I can put 10,000 rows into spreadsheets, no problem. And for many companies, this is the master database of all the customers. I mean, for like the majority of companies, this is the master database. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of this journey is kind of start extremely low tech. And yeah. If you are putting everything in the MySQL database, you immediately kind of make this big kind of wall around it. Only developers can even integrate or see the data. And so the kind of field, the technological landscape of systems which carry data is very large. Yeah, the trade-offs are just very subtle, because then there's also the vendors who say, oh, just bring everything to Databricks and then everybody will be in your kind of Unity catalog and you will be happy. And then I'm like, no, they are in Google Drive or in, I don't know, my FTP server or in my other system. So can you like talk a little bit about this kind of set of trade-offs and challenges? And maybe do you have an opinion or a sweet spot that kind of should work for medium-sized companies?
So a data contract really can apply to any data set on any technology. It could be, I always use this example of CSV files on an SFTP store, very similar to what you're talking about. It could also be a data set behind a REST API, where you can go through the data set through pagination. It could be SQL tables. But in the end, it's always a data set. So regardless of how you access it, is it just a GET query? Is it and it takes some time? Yeah. Or do I have to query the whole Kafka topic to get all the data? It's, in the end, the data contract protects a very or a large data set and gives the guarantees around that. And that's, and we have to, and then I would agree totally with the tooling support. The value, it's nice to document it, and it's already nice to say, well, this is what I offer, and potential consumers can have a look at it. But the benefit comes from automation. And I'm co-maintainer of the data contract CLI that can automatically read YAML structures written using the Open Data Contract standard, and then it can automatically connect to a data source and check whether the guarantees are met.
Oh, okay,
that's now very popular. And that's the key to win the hearts of your data engineers.
Well, that's actually important and interesting information. I mean, I have been circling around this for a while, but I have not really come across those concrete tools. And so is that kind of the way forward right now, that we have this open data contract spec, that there are some maybe open source databases you can already use for managing data contracts, and then there are vendor solutions which are kind of adding value on top?
Yeah, this is the current situation. I see it. I think we are in the data world, we are in this spot where open standards are really driving a lot of things. Like when you think of Iceberg, that changed a lot in the data world. And I think that the Open Data Contract Standard will have its impact. And there will be an Open Data Product Standard. There will be more standards coming as well. I'm working together with a lot of great minds on that.
Nice.
But the combination is with open source tools for making use as an engineer. And we see where the vendors come in is this in these central platforms. Now, where everything comes together. We talked about the data marketplace. We see also the trend here. There you see their data product, you see your contract, you see the validation results next to it. You see who already has access and why. You can request access and provide a purpose. All these things together, I think this is really how I see the current world.
It's pretty interesting, Simon, to me. Usually I would say engineers have a kind of dislike for like specifications and specifying a lot of things. Would you mind sharing a little bit about the history? If I remember correctly, when Jochen and you built data contracts, it was in parallel to an initiative at PayPal. And what was the reason or the use case that you had for building this spec, and how did it evolve since then into open data contracts?
Mm-hmm. So we started datacontract.com with the data contract specification. And we started it because we realized the key part of a data product is actually the interface around the data sets it shares,
mm-hmm.
like the API. That's where the music is playing. This is the essential part. But for it to work, you need to specify it in an open API spec. But there's you have to make it in combination with a tooling, with an automatic verification, and also use it for. You can also generate a lot of stuff like your code generators from OpenAPI. That was basically one of the things why OpenAPI was so successful. It was because of those generators, because of the automation around it. And we had the same idea. We wanted to say, okay, we have the data contract spec now. let's build the automation around it so to make it successful. At the same time, data contracts were invented in several places. We have this at Go Cardless with Andrew Jones. We had this at PayPal with Jean-Georges Perrin. And what Jean-Georges Perrin did is basically he convinced the people at PayPal to open source it, their own format, and later pushed it into the Linux Foundation as the open data contract standard and try to find a lot of people to support this. And we also realized that we looked at it, and in the initial version that from PayPal, it was still very PayPal specific. And so we invested a lot of time to make it more applicable, like for other companies, for other technologies, because PayPal was using BigQuery a lot, and so it was very BigQuery specific, but not everybody's using BigQuery. And now we are basically saying, and basically we also realized that it's much better to have a standard where a lot of people are behind than do your own thing. This is why we said, hey, we put all our resources together, and the open data contract standard is the new way forward. And we are basically sunsetting the data contract specification. That's kind of the history in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
And maybe just to add the data contract CLI, the automation that's already supporting the open data contract standard as well, because this is, again, automation is the key to adoption in that case.
So to make it easier for developers to use, right? To make it simple to do the right thing.
But to get a benefit. So it's not just the documentation exercise, but you get this benefit of checking whether your data, your interface matches what you specified. Is the table I produce, is it the structure as I defined in my data contract? And you can just run that in your CI/CD pipeline while you develop.
I was going to ask, is it similar to consumer-driven contract testing, where you can integrate checking your data contracts against your latest build?
Yes and no. The cool thing with data contracts is that you basically can, when you have access to the data, you can check it. You don't need a complex mock system. Mm-hmm. At the moment you get access, you can run and verify whether the contract or the data that you have access to matches the contract.
Okay,
there's
that
no
means
complex setup required to execute that.
But I'm thinking about systems that have different environments. I don't know, a developer environment, integration environment, demo environment, production environment. Mm-hmm. You would have to run the tests if you say you actually validate against the real data that is stored in the system. You would have to validate against all of these environments, right?
Yeah, if you want to. Mm-hmm. And they might differ a little bit. Maybe you have. Because
that would be my question. Like, do you already have some experience, some recommendations that you could give to people in terms of when you update your data contract, this is how you should run the validation. This is how you should run updates in terms of process, communication to others. Because I assume you will not run an update of your data contract on all the systems, on all the environments at once, but say, I don't know, you first release it to an integration environment and inform people. I don't know. What's your thoughts?
So first of all, only data in prod is interesting.
That's what you say.
Yeah. The problem is that other data in other stages, you can try to mimic the characteristics of your prod data, mm-hmm. but it's never true. Prod data. It's always different. It's hard to verify that when you do something, that's the right thing, mm-hmm. because it has. You can anonymize. You can try to retain the structure, but in the end, it's always different. So
you're a big proponent of testing changes in production.
Well, with if you can, data only is fun in prod. That's that being said, and that's also where others rely on it, and where you have to, you can use the contract to monitor, to continuously monitor the guarantees, because data is constantly flowing, data is increasing, data is appended to the interfaces. It's getting bigger and bigger, maybe also truncated, but it's normally getting bigger and bigger. And you can, with a contract, you can always verify whether the data still matches what you guaranteed. Doesn't break. The SLA is not broken at some interval.
Basically you do data monitoring. So you run, let's say, those tests every hour or whatever. And if it fails, you get an alert, for example.
Yeah, in a nutshell. Yeah. The problem is that it's costly because you pay for compute. Running those checks is paying for compute, and just using the BigQuery pricing model, you pay, I think it's $10 or $5 for 1 terabyte that you process.
Wow.
And when you have a large table and you process it every hour, and it covers 1 terabyte, and you really crunch through 1 terabyte for each check, then you can always have $10 or something.
In the end, it could be worth it, right?
Yeah. You have to. What I mean is, you have to make sure that it fits. Now you have to think a little bit about it. It's not just a little bit of unit testing during development with fixed costs. It's the data monitoring can be really expensive, and you have to really manage that.
Yeah.
But regarding to the stages, Alex, what you said, just one word to that. So what we recommend is using the contract, the validation of the contract also in the CI/CD pipeline during the propagation. You build and you check it against your testing, and then in your pipeline you can push it further to staging, and can also run those data contract checks against the data API on your staging environment, and then at the end you publish it in production. And in production, I would rather go just with the monitoring.
I had a look at the Data Mesh Manager, and I believe, it's like 5 weeks ago. So when I looked at it, I think I saw like all the data products. And if you look at the data products, you see, the status. Is it, are the data correct? Whatever the contract promises, is that true? So how often, or is it even the case that if I go to the marketplace and I publish my data product with a certain data contract, that this marketplace, data contract manager, that you guys also execute once in a while those contracts, or is it only executed once?
That's the monitoring aspect. No? It should be, or we execute it through a schedule. Because in production, you want to monitor it. When you move through the stages, it's not that important to publish it to others. You can still publish it if you want to give people insight into your dev or staging environment. To document that. But in the end, it's not that important.
Yeah. I'm only here in this case, I'm only interested in production.
Yeah.
And how often is it then executed?
You have to define that yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that's, again, it's costly, and we can't, nobody can make that decision for you. And cost ops is also very important there. Because it's, you have to manage that. But it's also, that's kind of the idea of a data product also to check when it's, when you have no customers, then you also shut it down again at some point. So you don't run the checks anymore. You can also shut down the data product, remove it at some point. That's this whole life cycle is also in there. That's also new in the data world where people thought we could store data forever. And at some point the data will be valuable.
Mm. Who is then responsible for all that? So, usually I would say product thinking. Well, you could say everyone in a team should have that product thinking, but in general, you have product manager, product owner who cares about the thing we are building. Is it also the product owner who is then responsible for the data product, looking how successful it is, you know, talking to customers?
Yes.
That's okay. Okay.
Yeah. In the best case, it's that simple.
Are there new roles emerging? Data product manager?
We see it a little sometimes here and there. I think these roles emerge for teams that just build data products. And then they just rename the product owner. That you know from operational teams, they name it differently because they only have data products, so they're the data product owners.
In practice, how do you discover your clients? How do you know who is querying your data set and build stuff on top of it?
So the idea that we have. With the marketplace that before you can access it, you have to request access or get access. Things like the App Store in Apple, where when the app is free, you still have to say, I want this, I agree to the terms, and you just get it. There's no approval. It's just installed. And the same we say here, because we always want to track not only who's using it, but also why.
And also have a back channel, right? In case something occurs, you need to communicate something to your consumers.
Yeah. It's just this know your customers idea.
Yeah. But would you distinguish here between experimentation and production workloads? Because as a developer, yeah. I mean, oftentimes I'm just like, let me see what I can do with that data. Just give me a piece of it. And if I have to kind of go through a process here to get access, that may slow exploration down.
What we recommend is basically it's auto-approve. You just click get access and you just get it.
Depends on the data, it's still
an additional step. It's not just I have access to everything and I can do exploration on all the data anytime. I don't think that GDPR is also happy with that approach. To some extent.
I mean, for certain data sets, right? I mean, internal data sets, I mean, from my perspective, there should be no restrictions on any employee just looking at, like, for example, what are my applications? All the tenantry systems are purposefully completely open. So everybody can kind of look into the logs of, no, not the logs, but the traces of a lot of the applications that we have. And I think that's important. And so there's this balance of, okay, yeah, you can make a security guard in front of everything, and then you just play the approval and review game all day, or you can kind of have some, more like less strict access, but for me, I think the sweet spot is allow experimentation, but not production use. So if I have a production application that is kind of depending on it, I want to know about it. But in the data world, that's often not so clearly cut because a data analyst that prepares a management report every Wednesday is kind of a production user, if you like, right? Although he may come through a CLI on his notebook.
So we think. And I agree the experimentation should be easily supportable. What we do there is that it's that you can easily request access for maybe a limited time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Simon, now that you founded a company around that, I'm hearing, well, you have to think about this, you have to think about that, there should be a process for this, there need to be people who take care of this and that. Is there actually something like a map, like a landscape that you use to explain the idea of data contracts and the data contract manager, your product, to your prospects? And say, this is why you should use it, because these are the roles that you should have. These are the processes that you need to put in place. And actually, we build the automation for that. Is there an overview already? Or are you going to create it before we release the podcast?
So I should probably run straight at that. The funny thing is that most customers basically just come to us and say, yeah, we realize we need that data marketplace. We're already hooked. But they basically all need a little bit of assistance, a little bit of consulting. And I think that what you said is, we know that in our heads, it might be helpful to write that down. And we try to write it down here and there, but there's not this here, go there. This is the one size fits all. That's also a little bit complicated because every company has their own quirks in that space. But in the end, this is kind of our approach. So we encoded our best practices into the product, including the processes.
Mm-hmm. I now thought that you say go to datamesh-architecture.com.
Yeah, that would be my follow-up question. Yeah. Do you have to have a full-blown data mesh architecture until the least bit before you can actually think about adopting data contracts?
No, you can start. Whenever you share data in a company from one team to another team, you can use a data contract.
So it could also be like a pilot use case. Let's try out data contracts between 2, 3, 4 systems in order to understand whether that would help our data governance to move forward.
Yeah, and it's actually a very easy one. Yeah? You can do that very decentralized. You don't need a lot of people. You just need access to the data. You need a place to put the YAML. Mm-hmm. And you need a CI/CD pipeline to run the data contract CLI using the YAML file and connect to the data.
And I know it's pretty hard for you to answer a question, but are there alternatives to using the data contract manager to serve your data contracts?
Of course.
But I won't recommend them.
It's all crap.
Well, when you go into details, there are differences, and mm-hmm. I think
Let's talk about the options that one has when they want to get started with data contracts, and why you think data contract manager is a good way to go forward.
Yeah. So I would first and for all always start with the open data contract standard, because this is really a standard driven by a group of very diverse people from vendors, end users, and consultancies. And I think this is the future. Then you need some kind of automation. You can use the open source tool for free. It's very popular. We have we have over 80 contributors and over 650 GitHub stars, and it's really rising. So this is what you can do for free, and you can go a long way with it. And then what you need, I think, not when you go bigger, you need one central place where you have your contracts, you have your check results. Mm-hmm. You need to know who's the owner there. You need a way to contact them.
And that's the marketplace offering, right?
In that sense. Now you need this kind of software, and it mm-hmm. should be able to read and support that YAML format that you have. Now it should. Have a lot of other features around it. But in the end, this is what you need. You need the central place to manage. And there are others that can do that. It's not unique. But we are unique that we have a very strong support of those open standards. But others will follow. So but at the moment we have this support.
When you say central place, would you agree to Heinrich's idea of saying we make this open for everyone so exploration can freely flourish? So if you say central place for all the data contracts, does that mean that you share them somewhere so that everybody sees what is offered there?
Yeah. So what we recommend from the permission model is that everybody has read access to the metadata.
Mm-hmm.
So you see all the offerings. You see all the check results. You see who's owning it, who's using it, for what purpose. And you see the whole graph, so to say, of that, you know, with the data products, the contracts, and the usages. But to use the data, you have to request access or just say, I want to have access, and you get it automatically, just one click, and you get it for exploration. This is what I think makes sense.
Okay. Maybe to spend a look into the future, where do you think are the data contracts going? So what is the perspective for the specification, and maybe also the roadmap for Data Contracts Manager?
I think the future is very agentic, and AI is everywhere. So what we already explored, we build a data product MCP. So an MCP server in front of the data mesh manager.
Jake.
you have to do that at the moment. But the idea is really quite nice, because the data contract is the source of truth of metadata. What's in the contract, that's true. Now, the data can be wrong, could deviate from the contract, but the contract is highly curated, highly valuable metadata, and it's very condensed. And with that, we can make a lot of use in an LLM, in an agent. So what we did is basically said, hey, you can find data very efficiently. Now you can request data. You can discover all the data products you have, all the data contracts you have, quite easily through this MCP. Now it can, based on your use case, you just as a business user go there and say, who are my top customers, or I don't know, any other use case. Then you can search our metadata database, search for the data products that might be interesting. You see the data contract, you can evaluate whether the data fulfills your need, whether you can answer the business question where we started with the data contract. You also see whether you already have access. And if you don't have access, it could immediately request access. And if it's like auto-approved, it's just for exploration, it could grant that for that specific purpose. And it knows the purpose because you already have given the business question in the beginning. And all this can be done in the MCP. And then you can also query the data, because you can construct the SQL query based on the data contract. You know the structure, you know where it's located, and you can run the SQL query, but then you also know why you want to use the data. And we can check whether the governance policies, whether it's allowed to query that for that purpose. And this can all be done. And so what I'm proposing here is basically that in the future, our most popular customer will be an agent using the MCP server.
Mm-hmm.
For the consumer side. Now, the producer side will still have to define the data products and data contracts.
Mm-hmm.
But the consumer will mostly be people oh, this is my Claude desktop. This is my MCP server I connected. And I just use it. And it's just handling that on their own.
So thinking about automated validation by agents that are, I don't know, training models by themselves, creating reports, or doing whatever else will be done in the future with the data.
You can also do things like check whether two data products are similar, which is the better one. Should we do we have duplications? Should we retire one? Is one data product included in the other? Or all these things we could monitor the whole data mesh also through that approach. And maybe we also integrate AI into our product itself to handle this request access flow. No, I request access from you, Alex, perhaps. And now you have to check whether my access request is valid. And that's a lot of burden because you have to know all the policies that might lead to rejecting that access. Maybe it's not, my course is not good. It's not allowed, perhaps. And that for that, you have to know a lot. And here we can also use LLMs because they can go through GDPR, they can go through your privacy policies, through your license agreements, and check whether my purpose, my usage scenario fits that to lessen your burden. Now it's easier, then it's not so hard on your shoulders. And this is also where we see a lot of impact now on this using AI, automating what previously data governance experts have done. And trying to automate the 80% and leave the 20% where it's not so clear to the humans.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. Are there things that we missed, topics that you definitely want to have covered, Simon?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think we covered a lot.
Okay. So as the CEO of Entropy Data, are you going to take vacations still this year?
Well, fun story, actually. So we founded the company at beginning of August. And just think almost in the second week, I went on holiday for 3 days. So
exhausted already.
Yeah. So exhausted already. I just wanted to phrase it a little different. I want to put it in the perspective of, I have a great co-founder, Jochen. We have a great a team there. So taking a few days off is never a problem.
Oh, okay.
That's what I wanted to say.
Okay. It sounds good. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming. And lots of success in the future. One thing we didn't mention, and that is, it's if our listeners know the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar put your product into assess. Am I right?
Yeah, and it was an interesting entry because It was named Data Mesh Manager, but in the text, it was three things. So we said the Data Mesh Manager as a product, the Open Data Contract Standard as the standard to go forward for data contracts, and the Data Contract CLI as the way to the open source tool to automate the check. So it was actually three things put into one.
Nice.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. So again, thanks a lot for your time, Simon, and for answering all our questions.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Okay. Then I would say have a nice weekend.
Yeah. Thanks to all the listeners for taking the time with us.
Exactly. Thank you for making it so far. All right.
See you next time.
I would say. Bye-bye. Cheers.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.